It's great to be here with you this morning. We have really, really fond memories that we share with some of you, but most of you not, because it's 50 years ago. I do remember Tony as a young kid. That's all I'm going to say. Pat is not here with me this morning. Sarah Wenger Shank is speaking at Park View, and she didn't really tell me this, but basically the point was she's heard me enough. So, a couple of other connections that are warm memories for us. Sarah's mother, Sarah Piper's mother, was our favorite English teacher at Iowa Mennonite School, now called Hillcrest Academy. And her grandmother, Bessie Yoder, who lived to be more than 100 years old, was a lifelong friend of ours. And I told Sarah this morning that I have a lot of stories about her, which I will refrain from sharing with all of you, but I would love to share some of those with Sarah. It may have been a kind of midlife intellectual crisis, the sort of crisis for which a sports car isn't necessarily an effective answer, although I will admit that sometimes I occasionally dream about driving one. It was about 25 years ago, chapel service at Heston College. And the title of my message was, "This I Believe." The thesis was, the older I get, the more deeply I believe some things, but the more I question some other beliefs that I've held tightly for many years. Life experience has a tendency to complicate things. Easy answers, formulae, cliches, yes or no responses seem inadequate in the face of complex realities. As a professing follower of Jesus, I told the Heston students that I've become more deeply committed to nonviolence and peacemaking. And I acknowledge now that perhaps it's easier to be committed to that, even to acknowledge that I'm willing to lose my life for the sake of what I believe as an older adult. But when you're 19 or 20, that's a little harder to make that commitment because your life is presumably still stretching far into the future. The idea that following Jesus is best lived in the context of a community of faith holds a lot more meaning to me now than it might have earlier. Walking through the joys and challenges of parenting and now grandparenting makes one keenly aware of the need for others to mentor our children and grandchildren in the faith. This I believe more deeply than ever. Our long-held affirmation of commitment to the kingdom of God that supersedes any national or earthly political entity means far more to me now than it did when I was baptized at the age of 16. Who among us has not thought about that question in recent years? Many Anabaptists wrestle with conflicting thoughts when we celebrate national holidays like July 4. And let me state it a bit more directly. Anyone who has not wrestled with that question of nationalism should probably, in my opinion, not claim to be an Anabaptist. There are many other questions that vex the human mind for followers of Jesus. Ultimately, death underscores that God does not always provide physical healing in ways that we might have prayed for and expected. We regularly pray for protection for our loved ones, but bad things still happen. 4 years ago, I attended on Easter weekend the memorial service for M.J. Sharp in Kansas. And you had to ask the question, how does one make sense of the senseless? And several weeks after that, I cried as I read the reflections from his father, John, written on the first Father's Day following MJ's brutal murder. We've all gone through agonizing experiences. Our congregation at Park View has suffered the deaths of more than a dozen congregants in the past 18 months, some from COVID, some from vehicle accidents, some after many years of life. And it's human to ask the question, why? Some things I believe more deeply, other things I hold much more lightly. The response to that chapel address at Heston College spoken from the very spot where MJ's service was held many years later, was unexpected, surprising in two ways. First, that the students were actually listening. Apparently, they were actually interested to know what a college administrator actually believes. Or, for the more cynical, they may have even been asking the question, does he believe anything? The second reaction was more unexpected. The chapel services were scheduled just before lunch, so we would dismiss the students and faculty and staff from chapel, and everyone would make a straight line to the cafeteria. Within a few hours, an email came from a few students with a list of questions, and over the following days, a number of opportunities came to have some in-depth theological conversations. And at the heart of the students' discomfort was the fundamental assumption that maturing in faith is synonymous with depth of conviction about one's beliefs. In other words, from their perspective, certainty was positively correlated with faith development. In their minds, remember, they were mostly first and second year college students, a 40-something adult who's been a declared follower of Jesus for more than two decades, who has served as a pastor and an administrator in Christian college, should by definition have figured it out. For a mature adult, I'll put the mature in quotes. Remember, I was 43 or 4 at the time. Should have been mature. To confess that there are more questions about some aspects of faith rather than fewer was unsettling to them. But fortunately, at least for a few of them, there was an interest in continuing the conversation. A few days later, a group came to our house for several hours of great interaction about these and other questions. Fast forward to a few years later. About 3 years after Greg Boyd's book, Benefit of the Doubt, was published, my then 93-year-old father was failing physically. The title of Boyd's book is, the full title, Benefit of the Doubt, Breaking the Idolatry of Certainty. And my dad was wrestling with questions of certainty, certainly not uncommon when having huge amounts of time to anticipate death. Boyd challenges the idea in his book that a person's faith is as strong as it is certain. He invites us to embrace a faith that does not strive for certainty, but rather for commitment in the midst of uncertainty. Trust in God is more important than absolute certainty about a checklist of beliefs. And Boyd desires to suggest that the mindset in which our top priority is to be certain is misguided, self-indulgent, idolatrous, and even dangerous. But as he puts it, I completely understand why a multitude of believers try to cling to certainty because it feels good. Another theologian, Peter Enns, now on faculty at Eastern University, takes a slightly different tack in his book, but it's essentially the same subject, the sin of certainty, why God desires our trust more than our correct beliefs. And Enns points to the biblical story for many examples of patriarchs and matriarchs of the faith who finally had to rely on trust in God rather than beliefs. And he reminds us of the saga of Job, and he exegetes that familiar passage which Paul just led us in. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely on your own insight. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. The Bible is full of stories with this human dilemma. Created in God's image, it's no surprise that you and I are gifted with the capacity and desire to know, to seek truth, to understand, to explain things, to be curious. So as far as we know, this insatiable desire to know is one attribute that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. As little children, we ask the question, why? As grandparents, we are faced with that kind of question all the time. Why this? Why that? And to be sure, that insatiable desire to know has led to a lot of good things in our world. Many, many inventions. Much of our current life is inundated by those inventions that were the result of that insatiable desire to know. When we moved to Eastern Pennsylvania in 1978, 11 years after the moon landing, I had a conversation with one of our elderly congregants who insisted that that was simply a program on TV. Or as my Pennsylvania Dutch friends would say, TV, which is, I think, how she said it. It was just on television, she said. When Neil Armstrong spoke at a prayer breakfast here in Harrisonburg a few years ago, I told him that story and he just chuckled, and then he insisted, indeed, he had walked on the moon and it wasn't just made up for TV. But that moon landing was the result of human desire to know, to understand. We all benefit from that. So it's logical to seek knowledge and certainty in one's spiritual journey. But therein lies a vexing conundrum. At the very core of the human being is the desire to know, to be certain. But then we very quickly run into the limitations of our humanness. Confronted by the boundaries of the human capacity to know without a shadow of doubt. And Boyd puts it this way: as people of faith, you and I should always be willing to accept our human limitations and to say, this I believe with deep conviction about such and so, but I may be wrong. To assert that there's no possibility that one could be wrong is to have crossed the line from humanness to deity. And then he offers yet one other important caveat. If I'm in a search for truth, which is a very human desire, and I say that I have found the truth, certainty, I am by definition no longer in a search for the truth because I've found it. Call off the search. So that was apparently the debate that was going on in my dad's mind as his body slowly deteriorated and he wanted to die. He professed faith in Jesus. He was clear about that. He knew what he believed about many things. His life was a testimony to his faith. As a young man, he had served his country through civilian public service. And as a business leader, he expressed values that were rooted in his understanding of discipleship. But in the end, like all of us will someday face, he had to confront the reality that his certainties were different from some of his friends and neighbors, most of whom were also followers of Jesus, and that begged the question, who's right? In both the Old Testament texts for today, from Jeremiah and from the Psalms, we see the prophet and the psalmist wrestling with those who would wish them harm and ill will. They have responded to such threats within the norms of human tendencies. Why me? Where are you? Have I not proven my faithfulness? So it's not a stretch for any of us to appreciate the questions that Jeremiah and Job and the psalmist would be asking in the face of their real life experiences as individuals. And if you and I haven't asked those questions, one could logically assume one of several possibilities. We haven't lived very long, or we aren't yet willing to be intellectually honest about our circumstances. So let me suggest that the invitation to trust God is also meaningful in a context much larger than any of us as individuals. It should also apply to our life as a congregation and to the broader church. I'm currently chairing the elders at Parkview Mennonite Church, and like I'm sure all the leaders in every congregation, we are wrestling with the tough questions: what comes next? What will the future of the church look like in light of what we have been through? And I think it's probably safe to say for most of us, it's a time of anxiety around those kinds of questions because we don't have much sense of how that's going to unfold. We're not walking on familiar territory. Our current situation begs the question, in whom do we trust? It's a question relevant to each of us as individuals and to us as a collective body. And maybe it's the most foundational question that any of us will ever ask, and the answer is both simple and profound. Ironically, every time we look at our currency, we see the phrase, "In God we trust." Which is really ironic, is it not? For a nation that spends more on military budgets than the next 13 countries combined? To brazenly print on our currency that we trust in God? Let me suggest that just like Job and Jeremiah and Jesus, "In God we trust" should be printed on our lives, but with several amendments. To claim that we trust in God is not an excuse to dodge responsibility. That could be what we really mean. Things are bad, everything's horrible, no one can be trusted, but I trust in God and all will be well. Several years ago, I was at a board meeting of the Evangelical Environmental Network. It's a group of evangelicals. I'm not on that board anymore, but it's a group of evangelicals who care about climate change. And we were having a board meeting in North Carolina, and the dinner before the board meeting in the evening, one of the servers came and said, "Who are you and what are you about?" And the president of the organization shared just very briefly what we were about. And her response was, "Well, maybe that's a concern, but I trust in God, it's all going to work out." What I wanted to say, I refrained. I wanted to say, "So when you leave work today, are you just going to walk across the street without looking both ways? Because after all, if you trust in God, why wouldn't you assume that God's going to protect you?" I don't always refrain from saying what I think, which is a joke. In our family, people say, "Where did that come from?" when I say something I probably shouldn't have said, and my typical response is, "Just be thankful that I only say half of what comes to my mind." But I kept my mouth shut, and I did not respond, but I pondered that for a long time. And I ask you that question: what does it mean to trust in God, but to also take action as human beings? To suggest that trusting God should supersede our reliance on beliefs is not to say that beliefs are meaningless. Just because some people in our society don't understand some things does not negate the realities. Beliefs are important, but they are clearly framed in the context of an individual's place in society, and they are bounded by the limitations of our humanness. As the Apostle Paul put it so succinctly, we see through a glass darkly. So I invite us as individuals and as congregations to put more energy into trusting God for the future than into defending our certainties about our beliefs. Amen.